Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. I'm Dave Krueger. I'm eager to begin this collaboration with you. I know I'm a minute early, and I appreciate the other early birds who are here with me. What I think is a really important area of stress mastery and peak performance. You probably have seen the downloads at the site, that the link that was sent around and that I sent again in the letter to you. I'd suggest you print the outline. It's a fairly annotated outline that you can follow and not have to take a bunch of notes. And there's also the resources and exercises, the second document to download and print. So we're going to look at the latest research and application on optimum performance under pressure and practical understanding of strategies that you can use yourself and with your clients in the business, the arts, sports, any kind of performance. I already have some responses to the questions I sent around. Thank you very much. You guys are fast. To the two questions of what's the most important question you want answered during this series, and for your optimum benefit, what would your best takeaway be? Those responses really help shape some of my discussion. And I already see that you're interested in application, maybe case illustrations and vignettes that will apply the mind, brain, and performance sciences to our topic today specifically and for the following four seminars. So this is being recorded, and the access to the online playback is at that, the ports at that site as well. So my hope is to be able to co-create with you in this collaboration a peak experience in itself. So I'll reserve some time at the beginning of each of the seminars for any questions or clarifications or things that we can discuss briefly, and ideally a bit of time at the end for any clarification or questions. And I welcome you to send responses to those two questions if you haven't already, and anything you want to communicate or add or ask, fire me an email if we don't get to it during our discussion. So, and you guys are doing a great job already to manage the background noise. It's star six or the mute button, so that we can do a discussion at the beginning and the end. I'll go on lecture mode in just a moment, so you don't have to worry about that. But anybody want to jump in and answer either of the two questions, or just say hello? Any things to begin with, including either of those two questions from anyone? Well, again, I appreciate what you've already sent in, and I welcome the responses about what would be most important to you, as well as what you really want to take away from this. What I'd suggest, and I welcome receiving any of these, I think it's important to write down, and I'm suggesting this to you, to write down at the end of each seminar just a single sentence about what's the most important takeaway from this seminar that you have. That helps to put it into an output channel when you write it. It makes it more retrievable, more of a memory. And remember, it's what we do with our coaching clients, to ask them at the end of a coaching session, what's the most important thing you're taking away? Based on that, what do you commit to do? So that summary sentence, even, I think can be important. So I welcome receiving from any of you your most important takeaway. So a last call for any questions or comments before we go on lecture mode. Anyone? Okay, I'll put us on lecture mode so you don't have to worry about the background noise. Okay, we're going to begin in our first seminar talking about some stress mastery strategies and tools. And I want to begin with one of my favorite little stories to give you an illustration and then to sort of deconstruct it and talk about it. When I was in the singles ski lift line at Steamboat Springs about to get to the chairlift, an instructor behind me who had five kids all about age six asked me if I would mind if a couple of them rode the chairlift with me. And of course, I welcomed the opportunity. I love stuff like that. As we got on the lift, the little girl next to me had a kind of an awkward seating and seemed to slump a little bit as we were riding and talking. As we got closer to the end of the lift to ski out of the chair, she said in a really timid little voice and looked right at me when she said this, "I'm scared to get off." And I looked at her and I said, "I understand." And then I asked, "Do you know who Laurie Hernandez is?" It was just after the 16 Summer Olympics when Laurie had won a gold in the team event and a silver in the balance beam. The little girl looked at me and said, "Yes." I asked her if she would like to know what Laurie did when she was scared about performing her gymnastics routine. And she immediately said, "Yeah." I told her that Laurie did three things. She pictured herself doing a perfect routine, a vision of exactly how she would perform. Then the instant before she began, she took a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension and said to herself, "I got this." Well, my new little buddy seemed interested and sat just a little bit more upright. As we were just a few seconds from getting off the lift, I asked her what she was going to say to herself if she got off, if she decided to. She said in a kind of a timid, hesitant voice, "I got this." And I nudged her. I said, "Say it like you mean it." Then in a voice that seemed to channel all of her 5.5 years into somebody I would not want to meet in a dark alley, she said very confidently, "I got this." And she skied out of the chair perfectly. And then about 10 feet away, she stopped, turned around, looked at me, and we did an immediate air fist bump of about 1 inch each, and we both smiled, and then she skied off with her instructor. Now, a brief overview. Over the last few years, we've seen revolutionary, and I'll talk about those components that I talked about with my little buddy in just a minute. In the last few years, we've seen some revolutionary changes in our knowledge of the mind and brain sciences, and especially in the performance sciences, to apply new tools to engineer optimum performance. So I want to synthesize and integrate these new frontiers to help you consistently attain peak performance mentally and physically and to facilitate it as a mentor coach. Neuroscientists estimate that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This means that the vast majority of our responses are based on established algorithms for behavioral, emotional, attachment patterns. This operating system ghostwrites beliefs, emotions, patterns of behavior, the shadow story system that operates on unconscious autopilot. Now, a script refers to the default modes of expectation, experiences, responses of how we write our stories. Our expectations inform attachment and behavior patterns that result in a typical, even stereotypical, response to certain situations. As we repeat our patterns, our brains wire those as the default mode. So the script for each scenario in our lives operates largely without conscious thought. You know, think about it, a family gathering, a board meeting, going to a restaurant. You tend to sit the same seat each time. You look over the menu, but then order the same thing. Now, to deconstruct this system, to understand the algorithms of patterns, of attachment relationships and performance behaviors, just to name a couple, we have to examine this default mode, the script. Change involves breaking the script. And this is the business of what we do as mentor coaches. We help someone examine and then change their script. Now, this is a challenge since 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious, but this is what we're listening for, and this is what we're going to be talking about in our initial discussion today. Now, we can engage in self-directed neuroplasticity, in other words, to create new behavior side by side with unlearning old automatic behavior. The approaches to changing behavior that work also consider what this does to your personal stories. In other words, how does it fit with your identity, and does your identity need to evolve to make it permanent? The answer is yes to both. So, how many of you know how to program a computer? Algorithms, pattern sequences? Well, we're going to talk about this in terms of our brain, and it's, for me, way easier than even thinking about it. An algorithm is a finite series of steps used to solve a problem or make a decision. And those of you who have done any work with me or training know I often repeat this. If you want to help someone change, don't focus just on the goal. Goals are great, but everybody has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goal. If you want to focus on change, look at the system. That's where we specialize as coaches, in helping someone co-create a system. So there are a couple of systems that I want to apply to our topic in this series. Both of these systems are included in the outline. So the neuroconditioning chart is a kind of a microsystem to identify stressful emotional triggers and a systematic way to rewire planned ideal responses for peak performance. The macro system is the roadmap system, the seven steps. The roadmap is the acronym, a strategic way to deconstruct and understand our stories, our performance, and to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior, especially to perform under pressure. Now, here's a word on the limits of algorithms from then Harris County Judge Ed Emmett. Here are his words. For Houston, Texas, 3 500-year floods in 3 years means either we're free and clear for the next 1,500 years or something has seriously changed. So there are limits to algorithms, but we're going to look at understanding and revising or creating new ones for various stories, and we're going to focus on performance stories here. Now, science, as you know, is about patterns, the fundamental laws and principles that form the foundation of our lives and world. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way the mind and brain work, though. So it's not about having all the answers, since most of our operating system is unconscious and not directly accessible anyhow, but about having an informed framework, including asking the right questions and an evidence-based system to implement strategic change for best results, which is to say to create an optimum performance story. Now, here's another perspective of what we're going to be about this series. When Dr. Helen Czerski was studying physics at Cambridge, she was in her grandmother's kitchen looking at textbooks and charts of quantum mechanics. Her grandmother looked at the material and said, "What can you do when you know that?" Dr. Czerski has spent an expert, accomplished lifetime answering her Nana's question and the unspoken follow-up question that she knew her Nana thought but didn't say as she waited for the answer. And why should I care? So we're about to answer Nana's two questions, spoken and unspoken. Let's start with several minds and then talk about two brains and one focus. That's what we do in coaching, but hang with me. We're going to talk about that. So we have several minds. A state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we process, and how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. Each mindset is its own software system, complete and internally consistent. Our mindsets frame the ongoing process of our operating system. Mindsets include powerful beliefs that inform the stories we write about ourselves. Researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology have recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the real world. The human brain operates sort of analogously to a Google map. When a new situation arises, different map is booted up. We have different states of mind or mindsets for different situations. That explains how important it is to understand the framing for a situation, the context, and to have a cohesive story to organize and direct that state of that series of maps. State always comes first, the state of mind, then strategy and story. A state of mind boots up a particular software program with its predetermined meanings, connections, internal association. Within a state of mind, just as within a software program, the patterns are predictable and consistent. When Susan gets angry with someone on the executive team, she will become more authoritative and demand better performance. When Robert's confronted with a challenging task, he'll engage an attachment pattern to get someone to make a decision that he'll sign off on. A systematic approach to breaking the script, which is our job description as coaches, addresses the default mode of algorithms played out in relationships, behaviors, emotion, performance. To revise a story, we first have to understand the script and then have a systematic way to address change collaboratively with our client. To recognize and own the process, to assess what to do differently, and create a systematic way of change. Those are the first four steps in the roadmap. We'll get back to that. The initial step of perturbation of the default mode is by definition uncomfortable because it breaks a script and automatic responses. A default mode, the script, has its own continuity. Even if it doesn't work as well, we still feel comfortable when things are certain. We're uncomfortable with change when we activate new processes that are different and disrupt the default mode. But that's how we learn. We don't learn when we follow the script and it works. If everyone followed the scripts of the people you know, we'd be out of business. Now, a stimulus such as a memory, a thought, a person, a place can instantly shift our attention. Once we focus on the stimulus, it boosts up a state of mind that then determines how we perceive and process everything that follows. I'm going to give you a case illustration in just a moment of the initial person I began developing the neuroconditioning program with and tell you how we went about that. Two crucial elements in performance become how to boot up an optimum mindset and how to fully develop skills within that mindset for the best results. To enhance capacity and performance requires deliberate practice and systematic execution for peak performance. We're going to examine both of these in detail in Seminar 3. Now, the brain rewires by focused attention on two things, possibilities and new experiences. The repetition of those experiences then encodes new learning in our neural circuitry. So here's a practical application to look at, and this is what we'll perhaps hear as mentor coaches with our client. We'll hear a surface story, and we may begin to listen and hear a shadow story. Now, the surface story is a usual logic, conscious intention, and assumption. This is what I want from life. These are my goals. The shadow story that actually ghostwrites behavior because it comes from that 90 to 95% of our operating system is automatic and unconscious. It may include beliefs that may or may not be all that unconscious. Now, I can't really get what I want. system keeps me from doing what I need. I wasn't really meant to have significant money. When the surface and the shadow stories go in opposite directions, stuckness results. I'm going to give some examples of this and how we listen, how we can listen for it in coaching. The surface story and the shadow story express both the desire and the obstacle, often simultaneously. The surface story, for example, can see money as security, freedom, pleasure, worth, depending on the individual. But the same brain may be wired to link it to the shadow story of greed or evil or selfishness or I really can't do it. A simple example of a surface story. I want to generate more income and create wealth. Now, the shadow story, spoken or unspoken, I don't think I have what it takes, or I wasn't born to have money, or what if I try my best and I can't do it? All of these are things that arise after stopping yourself. It's not the cause of stopping yourself. We'll get to that dynamic. We want one thing but may unconsciously do something else. The results reveal which is stronger. An inhibition is often the expression of a conflict between the surface and the shadow story, simply an attempt to avoid the dissonance of conflict, the discomfort of conflict. Inhibition then becomes the cure for conflict. If you stop yourself, then you're no longer uncomfortable. The biggest obstacle that keeps us from having what we want is the story that we create about why we can't have what we want. Play that back sometime when you have time to really think about it. I can't find the time. I'm not sure it would be worth it. I may not know what to do. So let's look at this from a brain perspective. A lot of this comes from a mentor of mine, Dr. Daniel Kahneman, who actually died 4 days ago, sadly. One of his, he's done research for in behavioral economics for many, many decades now. And his seminal book is Thinking Fast and Slow. I would highly recommend that. We have essentially two independent brain operating systems with competing interests, a top-down and a bottom-up system. They try to balance urges and logical reason. The most pressing conflict is not between us and the rest of the world, but between our two brain systems. So we want to save for the future, yet enjoy spending money on a purchase now. And our dopamine logs in to vote for now. We want to be healthy, balanced with wanting cheesecake, especially with strawberry topping. The balance can be tipped in various ways, but this is to approach how we can understand this process and create a system that works. When we write two stories simultaneously that go in opposite directions, it's not a metaphor, it's brain chemistry. One example is the reward center of the brain, the nucleus accumbens, that releases the pleasure chemical dopamine with anticipation of a purchase or something good to eat. The pain center of the brain, the insula, responds when we have to part with money to pay for what we purchased. So that's why credit cards are so appealing, because it separates the dopamine from the pain of having to repay. That's why people purchase 23% more when they use a credit card than they do cash or checks. Now, the bottom-up system runs automatically on impressions and feelings. It's immediate and intuitive. It operates, and it can't be turned off at will. This makes errors of intuitive and emotional origin difficult to prevent. And it also helps to streamline a lot of automated default decisions, and especially intuition. But I want to return to talk about how intuition can be misleading at a later point. Now, the top-down system, system two, the conscious logical seat of self-control, executive function, reasoning. This top-down system determines our voluntary attention and our choice, the considerations we make and the deliberations we make in conscious, logical decision-making. Now, when the bottom-up system prevails, decisions can shift toward impulsivity, especially when state of mind is not regulated. Overspending, overborrowing, overeating, other addictive habits can occur without conscious regulation or direction. A particularly challenging problem is the presence of unconscious biases that we have pre-programmed into the bottom-up system without the conscious awareness of the top-down system. And this is the two-brain system and some of the inherent issues in that. An awareness of the factors which, for example, lower our threshold to resilience against impulsivity becomes essential to recognize. I believe this is one of the most important things that we do with our clients, is to help them self-regulate, to regulate their state of mind, to manage emotion, and develop that self-regulation and self-reflection as a part of that. Now, willpower is a triumph of the top over the bottom system. Willpower may mean what we stay focused on in our goals despite urges or impulses or passions, but willpower can be influenced by a number of variables that can deplete it. Stress, sustained mental effort, even low glucose. So to Nana's question, why should you care? It's all crucial for deliberate practice, for skill development, for optimum performance. And we'll go about that in a more systematic way. Now, we've talked about several minds, two brains. Let's talk about one focus now. A pro tennis player was having an outstanding season in her career. We met just before she left for Wimbledon, where she was one of the top seeds. She was having difficulty with her serve. Her usual powerful, flawless serve was strained. Something was a little bit off, and she didn't quite know what. I asked her to take us, detailed frame by frame, through her usual flow pattern of serve, every aspect. Then to describe, a second way, then to describe what she was experiencing now that was difficult frame by frame. When she got to the point of tossing the ball in her air, she noticed an instantaneous flash in her mind of her coach looking at her critically. This literal nanosecond of moving from the flow state of her motor memory, of her deliberate practice that had been well-grooved to not think about it, to a thinking about it process, it disrupted that automatic well-grooved pattern. When she instantaneously and almost imperceptibly moved from the total reliance on that bottom-up system of deliberate practice and automatic performance, well-grooved with thousands of hours of practice, to a top-down system, to think about what she was doing even for a second, even that nanosecond of the picture of her coach, she hit the ball slightly differently. At her level of play, this meant everything. The power is in the focus. The unconscious mind does not distinguish positive versus negative or recognize future versus past, only focuses on one thing, here and now. This is the power of selective attention. The brain works sort of analogous to a camera. Out of all possibilities, what you choose to focus on determines the awareness and aligns the energy field of your brain for attention. So attention holds the key to choice architecture. Attention serves to regulate emotion and the state of mind that is chosen for that specific task. Successful performance execution depends on directing and sustaining focus to a specific choice and ignore all others. Here's a very simple example and application. My wife gifted both of us with enrollment in the BMW Racing School in Greenville, South Carolina, for an anniversary. It was a fascinating and masterful application of performance science, as I saw it, as we went through various aspects of driving challenges with pro racers over a three-day weekend. One of the very early basics they taught us was how to navigate sharp turns and curves at very high speed. Now, since our brains follow our eyes, when we look at where we want to go, we can create a successful turn even under pressure and high speed. If we look at the obstacle we want to avoid, our brain follows our eyes there too, and we get what we focus on. Focus on avoiding the obstacle, and you'll regularly hit it. When a coach focuses on what not to do with players, it can become a prelude to a choke. Someone getting analytical, especially self-critical, disrupts the flow of the bottom-up system, that well-practiced automatic response, to move outside that performance zone and become an observer with the prefrontal cortex, even for that nanosecond. The most fundamental principle is one we know quite well from neuroscience and quantum physics. You get what you focus on, not what you want. So look at where you want to go from the next curve to 20 years from now. Michael Phelps, most decorated Olympian with 22 medals, including 18 golds, described the significance of focus for him. When I'm focused, there is not one single thing, person, anything that can stand in my way of doing something. If I want something bad enough, I'm going to get there. That's focus. New neuronal networks and pathways are created when you focus on possibilities, on solutions. But if you focus on existing problems, the existing circuitry is activated and even further etched, even if you try to solve them. This is where people can get stuck in therapy or simply in repeating problems, sort of like regular meetings of the Ain't It Awful Club. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus, which is what we do in coaching, is more effective than a problem focus. These brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. Those of you who have worked with me, either in mentor coaching or training, know that, and have heard this way too many times probably, one of the first things I ask a new client is, may I interrupt you at some point if I feel it might be helpful for both of us at that moment to look at something you just said? And I regularly exercise that, especially when someone, let me tell you about a problem. I want to interrupt you. I know you got the problem down. Let's look at possibilities here. To reframe that to a different kind, looking at possibilities can activate new neuronal networks and pathways in the brain. Looking at problems goes down an already existing pathway. Even if you understand it way better or look at, you know, a bunch of different solutions, it still etches it further in your brain. That's how some people get stuck in therapy. We choose what we pay attention to. We mold our brain pathways and synaptic connections by what we focus on. Now, we can't control what happens to us, but we can determine how it affects us and specifically where we begin to direct our focus and attention. So a very simple example is that rather than focusing on obstacles that may hold us back, to focus on things that move us forward and the positive connections. So here's an oversimplified but three-step process to specifically counter negative thought or compromising negative self-talk. Reframe, and this is self-directed neuroplasticity, if you want a proper term for it. Recognize the thought, the negative self-talk, the negative whatever, as an error message from your brain, because your brain is hardwired to do this, to look at repeating something once you've repeated it, so it becomes automatic. And it's your brain's job description to do that negative self-talk because you've been doing it since you were probably five. Reframe the thought as an error message from your brain. Secondly, reframe to a positive framework of possibility at what you can do instead of repeating the problem. And then the third is refocus on what's next. So recognize, reframe, refocus. The three R's of self-directed neuroplasticity. So basically, this is to say simply, in summary, don't believe everything you think. Now, to regulate states of mind and manage emotions, this is an aspect that I want to spend a little bit of time on and give you an example. A state of mind is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns, a software program. A key element of mastery is to become aware of the various states of mind that we all have and to think about what state works best for what purpose. So the greatest challenge is to regulate states of mind, especially when there are emotional triggers and charged situations. I think it is the most important variable to determine successful performance of any type, intellectual, athletic, and everything in between. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach, and the meaning determines behavior. So by changing the state of mind, you change your behavior. So here's what we know as an application. A gap in performance has more to do with mindset than with motivation, intelligence, and practice. When a performer in any endeavor, athlete, surgeon, executive, has practiced essentially the same tens of thousands of hours as the next person, optimum outcome is determined more by specific mental state for optimum performance. So think about the things that lower the threshold to difficulty with state regulation, with management, or even susceptibility to emotional triggers. Things like preset meanings, like certain biases, certain emotional triggers, depleted energy, distraction, emotional overwhelm, too many choices, significant emotional charge, which is very close to specific triggers, and then a state of mind specifically after experiencing ineffectiveness or powerlessness, or in some work I'm beginning to do, to look at handling the accompaniments of extreme success, wealth, power, influence. That becomes difficult as well. So here's one example of how such influence can, even if it's slightly depleted energy, can cause people to fall back to an earlier default mode of thinking and deciding. Here's a study reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. 8 parole judges were studied for 3 years for their decision-making regarding applications for parole. The average rate of all the 8 judges over the 3 years for granting parole was 35%. The exact time of each decision was then studied in relation to the judge's 3 food breaks, morning, lunch, afternoon. After each meal, 65% of requests were granted, almost double. Just before noon and just before the end of the day when their blood glucose was lowest, the approval rate dropped to almost 0%. At these times of low blood glucose and greater fatigue, they resorted to a more critical and judgmental thinking. And this is just one variable, blood glucose. There are a number of other factors. I'll tell you a story of a financial consultant client of mine, if we have time, that is an application of this. So if you think about how many people actually have a flow experience, getting in the zone and sustaining that zone, that's when you're most likely to perform optimally. So the zone experience is a deliberate practice and performance in that zone. So here's an example. One pro athlete I worked with came to incorporate and apply everything we talked about regulating states of mind and entering his performance flow, his mindset, in his all-star career. He played football, so it was episodic. It's not a flow sport like basketball where you stay in the state of mind for us. But football is episodic. After every play, you got some downtime. If you're involved in a play, you do bad, it alters your state of mind. You do really good, it alters your state of mind. If the play comes nowhere close to you on the field, you may get a little bored. So it's important, especially. So after every play, he automatically said to himself, reset. He knew that in order not to have an excitement or a disappointment or a boredom carry over to this next play, he had to reset. So in a grounded and centered state of mind, he had access to all of his incredible skill for optimum performance. Any disruptive emotion after a big win or a big loss or a disappointment can hijack attention and disrupt flow. So we need a way to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. So the microsystem I mentioned, the neural conditioning chart, it's in the outline, page 14. If you would like a separate page with that, I can send you a separate page. It's about addressing self-regulation in a systematic way. Now, I want to give you an example of how this first came about and the thinking about it with my first client to do this. I'll call her Barbara. Barbara paused during one of our mentor coaching sessions as we were focusing on her executive leadership to mention, almost parenthetically, and a little bit embarrassed, that she was going to be distracted over the upcoming Thanksgiving holidays, and she looked forward to getting back and resuming her new project at her company. So I heard a kind of momentary discomfort and asked her about her expectations of the holidays. She mentioned that she's aware of a pattern in which every time she, and this is a high-functioning executive woman who was embarrassed to talk about this, every time she goes home to her family, when it is for one major holiday a year, this year it was going to be Thanksgiving, she has the same problems, the same struggle. She described the pattern, again, with reluctance and embarrassment. She said, we have a big family gathering where my parents, brother, sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different, that I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother and sister. She was in her early 50s at this point. I focus intensely on being balanced and not resorting to the squabbles and the upset. I can usually last most of the first day, and then something happens, and I lose it every time. I get in a fight with one of my family, which then seems to escalate. Then I'm in a fight with all of them, and we're in a standoff for the rest of that holiday. This does not happen except when I'm there with them. I can maintain my cool at times, other times, and with telephone visits, but in person, I just lose it. Is there anything you can do to help me with this? Well, I first reflected on how frustrating this must be for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family and have things work out otherwise, and she totally agreed with me. I said, at the time you're in the middle of that upset, in the arguments with them, what's the age of that conversation? She needed no explanation of that question. She knew immediately, early adolescent, I'm 13 or 14, instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. Now, Barbara wanted a close, meaningful relationship with her parents or siblings. She understandably wanted to share her personal and tremendous professional successes and experiences and hear the same from her siblings and about the transitions her parents were making. But in a state triggered by emotion, she only wanted to be right, to win, to be heard, to express her anger at not being understood, like at 13. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered her reaction. She described a particular look from her dad, a word from her mother, a gesture from her brother. It would instantly create that reactive mode. For example, when her dad rolled his eyes, she was instantly back in that time capsule of anger and resentment for feeling controlled and criticized by it, not being good enough, expecting negative judgment. That was all part of that. I recommended that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself, at least 30 minutes, when there would be no interruptions and no distractions, and she could reflect on a new plan. I suggested that she do what for her was to get very grounded and centered, so that she had access to all of her states of mind, and look at these triggers as an observer, not to be triggered by them, to write down each of the emotional triggers that she was aware of with each member of the family. I'd ask her to ask her to draw three lines and four columns. And this was column one, the emotional triggers. But to remain an observer, to not re-enter that upset with each trigger. So this was different, to be an observer of it. I suggested that for each emotional trigger in column one, she put in column two her usual immediate response without recreating it. So column two would include the thoughts, feelings, behaviors, the negative self-talk that were the automatic reactions to the emotional trigger, the upset. This was her age 13 time capsule. I suggested then that she schedule another brainstorming session with herself at another day, at least one day in between, where she would create a third column, a mantra for herself for getting centered and present for each emotional trigger. This is column three. The mantra is three parts. A cue to initiate the process. Barbara used the cue of touching her ring so nobody would see it. A focus phrase to align the energy field of her brain. Hers was relaxed and powerful. And a physiology such as a deep breath for relaxation, to breathe in relaxation, breathe out tension. This is exactly what I did with my little buddy on the in the chairlift. So the mantra may be the same sequence, the same cue focus physiology for each time to get grounded and centered. And each emotional trigger, though, column one, needs to be paired with an ideal response for that specific trigger. So this proactive planning ahead of a usual reactive response, but instead to create a game plan for how ideally she'd like to respond. So this was the neuroconditioning chart, because if you go all the way from the left to right, from the emotional trigger to recognize it, to get grounded and centered and substitute a new behavior, when you repeat that, it hardwires new brain, new responses. This is a way of rewiring your brain. And she sent me the initial draft of her four columns. I emphasized the purpose of the first two was to cue her radar to recognize not only the emotional triggers, but the state change and the content of that state as quickly as possible in order to use the mantra to get grounded and centered, column three. Then she could engage her ideal pre-planned response for each emotional trigger, column four. So in our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was really eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session by saying the best holiday she'd ever had with the family. There were times of challenge, even times when she had to excuse herself to use the privacy of a walk or just go into the next room to get grounded and centered. And I emphasized that. You know, you may want to call a timeout. You may want to go to the bathroom and splash water on your face. Whatever you need to do to get grounded and centered. You have an unlimited number of timeouts. This is not the NBA. So Barbara came to realize that previous emotional triggers, such as the phrase, really now, from her mother, and the particular eye roll from her dad, could be reframed as the recognition of their humanness, of her adulthood. This new attachment pattern allowed her to relate to them in an adult-to-adult way. And after significant repetition, she rewired her brain, a new default pattern, to create a different response to each cue rather than each resulting in a state change. So as Barbara noted about her Thanksgiving experience, that was incredible, but it was really hard work. And my response to her, I understand how hard and how successfully you worked. The only thing harder, as you already know, is not doing it. So that's an example of the application of that, what you see in the outline is the neuroconditioning chart. So this is something that I welcome you perhaps using to look at if you want to use it for self-regulation or for managing a particular state of mind or use it with a client. So sometimes these decades-old patterns of thoughts and feelings have not changed since the time capsule of each state of mind when it was formed. Now, this is why therapy doesn't work, as you are hearing now from a former psychotherapist and psychoanalyst, clinical professor of psychiatry practicing 25 years. We got a better way in coaching because every time you go into that state and try to rework it or have catharsis or in some way understand it or metabolize it, you only etch the pathway further. These time capsule also house earlier selves, experiences that come from an earlier time and place, yet it can be instantly activated with full immersion in that state. So here's a key point. It immediately seems like the content, the trigger, whether it's self-talk, the messages, the negative assumptions, it seems like those create this state. That's not the way it works. There's some emotional trigger that prompts that state of mind, and then all the things in column two, all the content of that time capsule, the negative self-talk, the doubt, the lack of confidence, those are all the result. So that's why it can't be approached directly or therapized, but you can regulate your state of mind and use that regulation to get to a different and better response to rewire your brain. So it's as if the story we tell ourselves about who we really are becomes who we really are, our core identity, our reality. And at times it's hard to distinguish the stories of a situation, the situation itself. And I want to come back to this because this is how we can help our clients create permanent change, is to incorporate this understanding and this evolving pattern of thinking and behaving and responding. That can be incorporated into an operating system to make it more automatic so that it becomes identity. And we always return to our identity, so it's important that when we're helping our clients evolve and create a new way of experiencing something, a new way of responding, that we also help them incorporate that shift, that transition into the operating model of who and what they are, because we always return to our identity and we want that operating model to stay current with current experiences, or they'll revert back to what they did before. And this is what makes change permanent. When what you help someone do creates a transformation in their identity. So the flow across all four columns, this is the conscious recognition of an emotional trigger that otherwise instantly created a state change, so that old state of mind with all the feelings, behaviors, beliefs in column two. So in summary then, column one and column two, the emotional trigger and usual response are simply to recognize more quickly an emotional trigger and the state change that it immediately induces. Cueing your radar to recognize this as quickly as possible means that you can see the process of the state change rather than staying stuck in the content of the altered state. That column two, that time capsule, the content will never change. You can't think, reason, you can't think, reason, feel, figure, or therapize your way out of a state of mind. So rather than getting lost in the content of the state, which is so common, instead address the process by being grounded and centered to then move to a pre-planned ideal response. for each particular emotional trigger. Now, as you do, and the purpose of doing this chart first is to recognize a little bit sooner, with a little bit less depth of that automatic response, the column one and column two, the usual trigger and the usual response. When you recognize it a little bit sooner each time and get a little bit less in-depth in the response, you have more reserve and can more quickly move to a way of grounding and centering to then move to that ideal response. And it's a process. It's not something you can just name it and make it so, or recognize it and suddenly it's done, because that emotional trigger is an anatomical reality in your brain. So you can't just recognize it and make it go away, or have a good idea and have it overwrite what's already there at an anatomical level. But you can have a systematic way of rewiring your brain and revising mind software to create change. Now, as you do this repeatedly, you may notice two things. The first is that you repeat your mantra, the cue, a focus phrase, and a physiology, like deep breathing. You'll notice that simply the cue alone over time will be sufficient to induce a deep, grounded, and centered state. Barbara did this enough, and she practiced enough before she went home for Thanksgiving by doing that mantra, the cue, the focus. She would simply touch her ring, take a deep breath for relaxation, and have the focus phrase that she practiced a number of times during the day. It also came to be very useful in her executive functioning before major presentations or important board meetings and that sort of thing. This is the first phase of neuroconditioning. You have to rewire your brain to use an automatic cue to induce a state, like touching her ring. As you move through all four steps to immediately engage an ideal response, when you repeat it enough, it'll rewire your brain. Ultimately, the initial emotional trigger can automatically couple with a balanced state of mind and an ideal response. The trigger won't be triggering, but can be a cue for ideal behavior, kind of a default optimum behavior. Now, this is the hard work miracle. Your brain has rewired its operating system. And elite performers in business, sports, the arts, professional performances, medicine, financial, know and live the wisdom that the more enjoyable the experience, the better the performance will be. My book with my agent right now on Hard Work Miracle is dedicated to my grandmother with this quote, my favorite quote from my favorite grandmother that I want to end with. If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So next seminar, we'll talk about the neuroscience of peak performance and talk about confidence, mindfulness, deliberate practice, and an important component of learning, which is unlearning. So if you'll manage the background noise, I'm going to go on discussion mode if there are clarifications or questions or anything that you want to add. Okay, we're in discussion mode. Questions or clarifications, anything you want to add or ask or talk about?
Hi, David. This is Danny Bedoni. Hello to everybody.
Hey, welcome. How are you, Danny?
Oh, my God. This is
great to have you here.
It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. It's a question. When you do this, all these columns, have you found a way that there's X amount of times that that your clients do this and they get it the fastest? Is it like 3 times, 5 times? What have you seen that has been kind of that magic number?
Well, first of all, there's no magic number, and that's why I call it a hard work miracle. Because by the time you're finally frustrated and don't think you have it, oh, there's a sign of progress. Now, the number
like
of...
Like playing golf?
For something really simple, and if it's a simple behavior and response, the repetitions of 20 to 30 days will create some rewiring. Remember the example I've given in another context, the down the road a piece here in Houston at NASA, the astronauts were put in a headset where everything was reversed. Up was down. They had to move about very, very carefully. And at day 25, they noticed that their brains had rewired. They could move about freely and easily. The ones who were given a day off at day 15, 24 hours off, when they put the headsets back on, they had to go 25 days before their brains rewired. So some things are simple responses, and you've probably heard the 20 to 30 days it takes you. Now, more complex behavior, more complex patterns will take longer than that, but the good news is that with reverting back to an old behavior doesn't reset the clock. You don't have to start back at day one. You simply recognize it a little bit sooner and go back to the ideal response, kind of like the neural conditioning chart. When you recognize a behavior, then you can get grounded and centered, go to an ideal response. Some behaviors that are simple and simple cause and effect can do in a month's time. Some will take longer. But the important thing is that you stick with it and that you recognize it so it becomes part of self-reflection and self-regulation at the same time, and it becomes a resource that you have, a skill that you develop that can be important in whatever you do. Does that make sense, Danny?
It does a lot, and I just was reading The Science of Happiness, and it said that everything was about self-reflection and self-regulation, so it works perfect for my clients. So thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. It's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. So self-reflection and self-regulation is the means to a better end, to look at how to better create and apply a system. And when you have a system already in place, like the neural conditioning chart, then you can simply get back to that, and you don't have to start from square one every time, but you have a map. And that's what we do in coaching. So thank you all. I want to respect our time. I know we're a minute over. Any thoughts, questions, things that you want to address or things that you think about or even answers to those questions, send me an email. I'll be eager to incorporate that in the discussion. And, I appreciate the responses that you've already sent in, and I'll incorporate that in our discussion. So basically we'll stick pretty much to the outline, but we may depart there's an application that just doesn't fit anywhere. So thanks very much. Have a great rest of the week. Look forward to picking up with you right here next time. See you guys. Bye now.